Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
What is dadication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dadication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
What is dadication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dadication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
Not all monsters are under the bed. Some are sleeping next to you. Welcome to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Dreeke.
Richard Allen, the man accused of being the Delphi murderer. We've been watching this case as it's led up to trial. Obviously, the trial has finally gone through and a verdict has been rendered guilty. That is what the jury found him. And as we've said from the beginning, this man, if any, has a get-a-new-trial free card. We'll get into that in just a little bit. Joining me to discuss, Robin Dreeke, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. I'm just going to throw it over to you. What was your reaction to this verdict when it came down just last week?
I had so many emotions at the same time, Tony. This is one of those cases that's going to be with me, and I know a lot of people, the rest of my life, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Disbelief was my first one because I still haven't changed my thought patterns. I've done a lot of reflection. You know, it's like my first reaction was I must have a blind spot. Mm-hmm. I must not see something that other people have seen. I'm wrong. I mean, it was really self-reflective and blaming myself for not seeing something that the jury saw. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going through my range of emotions. You know, I even reached out to you, as you know, I apologize. I must have been way off of what I said.
And I'm like, you're great. We all agree.
I know. And then I look at what Jennifer Hoffendeffer posted, yeah. and she does the same thing. She does a beautiful job of outlining the behavior arc. And I just keep going to data. I just don't see the pattern of his life that fits what he's accused of. And then I go, right after it's my fault, I go immediately to the families. I'm like, gosh dang, I really hope they feel satisfied with the verdict, mm-hmm. because I still am just always about the victims in this thing. And the only victims left now are Richard Allen's family and the girls' parents and families. And I hope that they have satisfaction with this, but it's hard to, it's just hard. It's just, there's so many emotions in there. And then I'm like, well, you know, then I start looking at the defense attorneys, you know, what could they have done differently? What could they have done better? They were hamstrung with so many things, as I know we're going to go through. It's just, unfortunately, from beginning to end, from everything you and I have looked at, analyzed, commented on, and all your other contributors, nothing has changed.
No.
And that's what's just disappointing. I still have not changed my mind on what I'm seeing and what I'm assessing, and yet he's guilty.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
You had a lot more self-reflection on this case than I did. When I heard the verdict, I'm like, they're wrong. I'm like, they're just wrong. They are just wrong. I was like, what did I get wrong here? I didn't get anything wrong. You didn't get anything wrong here. I mean, facts are facts. And it's not like you or me had some sort of inflated, maybe this could be possible story here. It's just based on facts and based on the data that is there. These are non-refutable things. The jury did not hear so many pieces of this case. Just as you said, is there something I didn't see? It's the other way, I think, Robin. It's what the jury didn't see. We saw everything. You know, in the mind of the jury, we saw too much. In the minds of the prosecution, we saw too much. They tried to tamper down anything they possibly can, and they played whack-a-mole to such an extreme on this case that it was spooky. It almost really makes you question, how is this part of our American justice system? How is one person or very few people allowed to have so much power over a case like this?
You know, you really hit it right there too. That's the most disturbing thing about this case to me, is how can this happen? That mm-hmm. there's still so many, I mean, I get that, you know, even with the Koberger case or any of the other cases, you know, there's a lot of gaps in data. But in every other case you and I have talked about, and all these cases that I generally see, there's always going to be gaps. There's always going to be data that you wish you had, a weapon, a witness, or something like this. But there's always that lifestyle behavior arc that says it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying he didn't do it. I'm just saying there's nothing that makes sense that he did it. That's what's missing for me. And they didn't allow that to come to light for the jury or during this prosecution. So after all my emotions of going around and self-flagellation and blaming, I'm back with you. I don't think we're wrong. It's not that I think he's innocent or guilty, because I want more data and I'm not seeing it. And until I do, I don't think he's guilty.
I don't think that anyone could render a verdict in a fair manner based on what was presented to the jury. And again, I agree. I can't say he's guilty or innocent, but I certainly can't say he's guilty based on an unspent bullet that was in an area where people are hiking all the time. It is a hunting area. So you do have people that are going to have those in their pocket. You had how many officers wandering around the area as well at the crime scene? It's a very likely possibility a bullet fell from someone other than Richard Allen. And the science of, it went through his gun. That's so bunk. I mean, run it through any gun, you're going to get some sort of a marking on it And then to say it's specifically his without any evidence, mind you, there was no scientific proof that went into this that said, oh, yes, this is why, look, we even have this. Or that. There was nothing. It was just, this is what we think. Same with the guy, the officer that testified going, that's his voice. Okay, like, what did you run it through? What's your testing method? Like, what did you, what program did you do to identify and get a signature that it is his voice? Nothing. It was just his opinion. it was truly shocking that you can have a judge just say, no, we're not going to let you plead all of these different, very possible, likely theories that even the investigators investigated or stopped investigating for no real great reasons, and not allow that in for your own defense. It's one of those things that's shocking. If you don't know how the court system works in this country, you don't understand that a judge can do this. I didn't understand that until I started diving into true crime. I'm like, really? A judge can just say you can't defend yourself using these theories or these arguments? Yeah, it can be done. That's how this case was done. That's how we got to this.
And just all these, just a handful of the other potential people they were looking at or could have looked at, their behavior arcs fit closer than his.
Oh, completely.
Even if there's like only one or two data points on them, that's one or two more than we, that came to light for Richard Allen. It just,
yeah.
And also I'm not a jury blamer, a victim blamer, you know, so I definitely the jury did the best they could.
They did the best they could. Yeah.
With the instructions that, because again, I don't know the instructions that they got. I don't know, you know, their perceptions. I did hear, I was on another show, and someone's actually in the courtroom during it, and I'm pontificating like I am now about, you know, what I'm not seeing, and this person came out of the courtroom saying, "Oh, the jury's going to convict him," and I was like, "Really?" Yeah. So I guess that the tenor in the courtroom was very different than, again, because we're not there, we're not experiencing it as they are, and also, you know, I really thought hard about this one too. I think they really wanted. And everyone wanted someone to be guilty. Yep. They want to find, you know, so there can be closure. And I get that. I just wish we all felt better about this.
I agree. The scary thing is about a case like Richard Allen and the Delphi murders is that people want answers. And that's the families, the neighborhoods, the communities, everybody. They want answers for what happened to these two little girls. There's nothing wrong with that. But oftentimes when we go on the path of trying to find answers, we put the blinders on. We go down this path and we think we know what we're looking for. We try to find that. And in some cases, that leads us in a good direction because, you know, sometimes those instincts are correct. But they searched for 5 years for a man and they never found one. And then they go back to old interviews. And oh my gosh, look at this one. We completely dropped the ball. How did we not realize we had this one? And there's really not a whole lot in this interview other than railroading him. But they went back to that and they said, oh, well, there's this bullet. Maybe we should connect this. And the rest is really history. Yet there are so many people in this case that you had mentioned earlier were not looked into or was just kind of touched upon. It's shocking. And I'm going to talk about some of these names. And these people, I'm not saying they're the killer or the killers, but I'm saying this is bizarre that there wasn't more of an investigation into this. You have Brad Holder, the avowed Odinist, initially a suspect due to his religious affiliations with Odinism and his proximity to the scene. The defense argued that elements of the crime scene, such as the rune-like formations, pointed to the ritual Odinistic killing. It was deemed inadmissible by the court because they didn't want to hear about his involvement. Just inadmissible. There's no Odinism here. You have Elvis Fields, identified by the defense as a person of interest very early on, alleged connections to Odinism, weird statements he gave about the crime scene, and knowledge of specific details that were not publicly available. Yet he wasn't our guy. I believe he even went on my social media and even like posted like kind of recreations of the crime scene. But nope, he couldn't have anything. You got Keegan Klein, a convicted child predator who at the time was not a convicted child predator. literally communicating with Liberty German under the username Anthony Schatz, talking about meeting up, talking about getting together the day of the murder. Later, he's arrested on child pornography charges, and he's serving 40-some years in prison. And then, of course, you also have Ron Logan, the owner of the property, who is now deceased, has a criminal history to him, never charged, and the involvement was also not presented. None of these options were presented to the jury. If you don't have any of that, how are you going to make an educated decision?
You know, each one of these people, especially, I'm going, was it Patrick Westfall?
That's the ones in jail. Keegan Klein is in jail.
Keegan Klein. Look at, you know, just do our own thought experiment here, as we love to do. Mm-hmm. Each one of them, especially that one who's in jail right now for being in communication, for child pornography, how much easier would it have been to prosecute him?
Yeah. Even if he has an alibi, who else does he talk to? Who else did he say, hey, these girls are going down there today, I know about it. When you want to go? Because, I mean, if they're communicating to their predator buddies, however that works, that could be a... it's not him, it seems like he's a pretty solid lead.
So in my mind, again, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an expert on that aspect of all these things, but if you have all these potential people that you can reasonably say to yourself, especially this one right here or the other one, that says, I could equally prosecute one of these people and have maybe an easier time showing this arc of behavior. And also, if you look at the stats, most of the time, unless they're a vagrant going through the area like we had in the Rachel Morin case, there is some knowledge and connection between the victim and the murderer. And we have that in at least in that one instance. And so what that does, and like you said, what the judge ruled out is reasonable doubt. If it could have been any of these other people, and I'm sitting here saying, well, that fits. It fits more than this and this, or at least equally fits. That's reasonable doubt to me.
It seems that what was pushed out of the case were all of the reasonable doubt options. It wasn't like, here's a fact, this is our killer. Because I don't know if any of these people are, but they all play roles in this universe of what is going on. And the fact that they didn't allow the jury to even hear those names, or at least put them into context, because they're all players in this, it is shocking. And in no way, I think, fair. It's just one of the many, many options that Richard Allen will have here on appeal. Beyond the people that were brought into the case of Richard Allen, or the lack thereof, because many of them never known, never made any sort of impact on the jury. It's going to be interesting to hear their reactions now that they're out of that position, if they're going to be kind of shocked by everything they weren't informed of. You have other pieces of evidence that never were heard. The Odinism theory, not touched upon at all. And I was saying towards the end of this trial, did we even need to go to Odinism? Because to me, on the outside, it felt like the defense didn't do a very good job at all. It felt like the prosecution really pointed out all of the weaknesses. And I thought, well, Odinism really doesn't even need to be in there. It couldn't be. The judge wouldn't allow it. But I guess I was wrong. Maybe they did need the Odinism theory. Do you think the Odinism theory would have helped this case, or would it have pushed the jurors even further to the side going, that's too fantastical, if we didn't have the rest of the context?
I think what could have helped is if you remove the label of Odinism and just put like a cult-like murder, mm-hmm. you know, or ritualistic type murder without an inflammatory or weird sounding label on it. Mm-hmm. You just say that, in other words, give it a reason, a motive for committing this murder was ritualistic, mm-hmm. Without giving it a particular label of meaning. I think that probably would have had more traction, just because it sounds better to the ear. I think if it's presented more in a pragmatic scientific way, not science of the supernatural or Odinism, but just mm-hmm. in a ritualistic kind of cult-like way, because there's tons of cases that there's cult-like ritual murders and things that happened. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you look at it, look at Lori Daybell Vallow. Mm-hmm. That was a wackadoo religious cult-like murder of her children that you didn't give any kind of religious label to. Mm-hmm. And if we had called that, you know, that it was Odinism, you know, that would have sounded a little weirder.
Yeah.
You know, see what I mean?
Yeah.
And also, you know, with these other people that had threads, I'll call them little red threads. You know, Richard Allen had one and they pulled on it. And these other potential people, they had these little red threads too. What they should have done is they should have done a deeper dive to see if they can pull that red thread and see if it dives deeper. And if it doesn't, because right now all these people look equal to me.
Yeah.
You know, they're all kind of here on the surface. That they went an inch deep instead of a mile deep on anyone.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's a great analogy. No, I mean, I feel very much the same. I mean, I feel like there's others that are standing out with far more interest than Richard Allen ever was.
Take a look.
Yeah.
If they go nowhere, okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, then we have less reasonable doubt.
Let's do the job first. Let's go down the line and see what we can find. The sketch is another big part of this case. None of them look like Richard Allen. But again, the prosecution, Gault specifically, said, no, inadmissible. The jury doesn't need to see the sketches that we all put out and said, this is our man. And he doesn't look a thing like the guy. That might be some reasonable doubt there that this person that people described doesn't look at all like your suspect. They also said, you know, this is a taller man. Any eyewitness who claims to have seen this man claims he was taller, like upper 5 feet, lower 6 feet. Richard Allen is 5'4". It's a pretty, you know, there's a big difference between 5'4 and 5'10 or 5'11. You can kind of mix it up, I think, anywhere in like the upper fives to lower sixes if you're just guessing how tall someone is. If you're in the lower fives, I think most people would guess you're in the lower fives. It's a pretty steep difference there by like a head. You're not going to, I guess, mix that up. I guess if you've been alive for any amount of time and know the basics of our measuring systems.
Guilt confirmation bias at play.
Yeah.
I really think that's it. And that interview really said it all to me. The transcript of his interrogation that they put out there was just they saw him as guilty and they went right to an accusation after a few minutes of rapport and trust where he starts disclosing and they immediately went into accusation from the very get-go.
What's interesting about all the video that they showed him, though, or that they showed the jury, there was ones of Richard not in that delusional state where he's just mumbling and going, I killed them, and then goes and eats, you know, Leviticus. You know, that's what he's been doing. He was eating the Bible. He was eating his own feces. He's running headfirst into a wall. And they're saying, well, see the video? He said he did it here. But where he's coming out of work from CVS and they're talking to him, totally different human being. One has not had a psychotic break. The other has because they've been in solitary confinement for that long. That's another one that really kind of shocked me. Does the general public, do jurors not understand? I mean, just the impacts of what that kind of torture will do to someone. I mean, even if it's spelled out for you, does the general public literally think, oh, I could stand that. I'm a strong man or I'm a strong woman.
No, you can't. Yeah. So, and I mentioned it in your other show too. I'm reading another one too. I'm reading I can't remember. So it's about Raoul Amundsen. This is the greatest adventurer and greatest explorer of the last couple hundred years. This guy is actually the first one to reach the South Pole. Mm-hmm. And, I mentioned, you know, the voyage of the Jelka. I can't remember saying it. It's a Belgian ship that got trapped in the ice pack down there in Antarctica. And even back then, the science and understanding of what isolation does to the human being is profound. And I've had people say to me too, well, he got 1 hour of sunshine a day. He got to go out. That doesn't do it. It doesn't do it at all. These people were trapped with each other. There's like 14 of them. And they still had two that became insane and one committed suicide when they returned and one down there. The effect of isolation on us as a species is profound. We are not genetically and biologically coded to be alone. And when you're put in isolation like that, it does horrible things. But that's why we have all these NASA studies for the travel to Mars. And even before we went to the moon, because it's not about Yes, it's about the distance, about the radiation, all these things. It's about the human isolation and what it does to us.
Yeah.
And you have to pick very specific people that can actually handle that. And not many can, if any. And so when you take someone like Richard Allen, who may be right on the precipice because he's self-described as having some psychological issues, he says he's suicidal, where he can function completely fine if all things remain equal. But then when you just teeter him over that edge, like you would anyone in that isolation, all the behaviors, and the psychiatrist or psychologist, I can't remember which was, that the defense brought on that talks about the effects of isolation on the brain, they did a great job there. I don't know why they didn't harp on that more, because it has a severe, profound effect on us and our physiology. Just read any history book, read any explorer book where someone's exploring anywhere in the Arctic, you know, in the North Pole or South Pole from around the 1700 to 1800 timeframe, you will see exactly what I'm talking about. And this is just not, it's just us as a species.
Yeah. It's just how we work. It is what it is. I want these families to, you know, have closure. Yeah. I know that's a cliche thing to say. Yes. When you lose your kid, you're never truly going to have closure. But have something that brings some sort of end to this chapter, just a bookend, the families being satisfied in some way, shape, or form, as much as you can after losing your child. I don't know if they are or not. I'm not trying to speak for them. I mean, from the perspective I have, if I was a parent of this, one of these kids, I don't think I'd be very happy. I would feel like, well, yeah, we named somebody. But mm-hmm. I don't think I'd feel very confident about this. Do you think the families are satisfied? I mean, I suppose it's easier to want to fit the square peg in the round hole, and maybe they did it here. But I think deep down, you probably know, was this the right peg for the hole?
I don't know. I had a tail end of listening to someone actually who was friends with the family on another show, and there's a lot of emotion that's going on with everyone on both sides, both the Allen family and the victims' families. And it's one of those things I don't know the answer to that. I don't presume the answer to that. The challenge I would think that they're going to have is the fact that there's going to be an appeal. And so the appeal process to me would not allow them to move forward. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what they need. It's one of those things, you just don't know what the families need. You know, like with all these other cases, I just want them to be satisfied.
Yeah.
I want justice and I want satisfaction for the victims. And I don't think we're there yet on this.
Yeah. One can only hope, what will happen next. It's likely going to go to appeals, and off of the laundry list of things that went wrong in this case, I would be shocked if he does not get an appeal or at some point. Now, that could take a long time. It might not be the first round. They're like, oh, yeah, you're good, depending on who it goes to. But, if Scott Peterson, if the Menendez brothers can get a second look at their case, this thing is screaming with inconsistencies that need a second look. It'll be fascinating.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what's that group coming in for Scott Peterson, the
Innocence Project. The
Innocence Project. This is ripe for the Innocence Project. There is no doubt.
Without a doubt. Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
All right, true crime addicts, let's cut the crap. You're knee-deep in the gory details of your favorite podcast when suddenly a commercial hits like a bad meal. Seriously? You deserve better. Upgrade to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, where you can binge without those annoying ads. Plus, get extended interviews that go deeper into the darkness and early access to episodes so you can be the first to know. It's like trading up from fast food to fine dining, but with more blood. So, go ahead. Search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe and feast on the good stuff.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
The new McCrispy Strip is here. Dip approved by ketchup, tangy barbecue, honey mustard, Sprite, McFlurry, Big Mac sauce, double dipped in buffalo and ranch, more ranch, and creamy chili McCrispy Strip Dip. Now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.